Welcome back, and that's what else? Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles. Eleanor Rigby, the real one, died on this day in 1939. Today on the program, we'll bring you some of our favorite segments from the past two decades of the Mark Steiner Show. What you're about to hear is a pre-record, so we can't accept any calls. Please send us any feedback to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome, good to have you all with us on our way into this conversation. I do want to say once again that breakfast this morning for our guests is provided by the Filling Station, which you can find at... You didn't get breakfast, man? Right in the next room?
Real talk?
You didn't get food?
Oh, I'm with that. Thank you.
And coffee's in there, too.
Yeah, I'm so with that. So with that.
I can't believe you didn't get your pastries and come all the way over here.
Been waiting for y'all to get a food hookup, hey, real talk.
I did it on the day you were here, and there you go.
With that.
So I want to remind you all that breakfast is provided by the Filling Station this morning. Filling Station in Sparks, Maryland, out on York Road. They're open Monday through Friday, 6:30 to 5 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. They have homemade Mexican food made by Maria, which is just unbelievable, and coffee and drink menu with soups and more. So please, we'll get you out there. Right now, we're going to turn our discussion with our guests here in studio. We had several shows over the last weeks that raised issues, months I should say, that raised issues around race and class and where those kind of strange, where those two entities that define this country and life kind of meet and intersect. And it raised a number of questions. It raised the questions of what is one a priority over the other? Does one take precedent over the other? Do they intermingle in kind of strange ways? Many people would argue that, as someone did to me yesterday, actually it was Carla Wills and I were talking about it, and talking about how during the Civil Rights Movement, it was, even though led by some black intellectuals out of the middle class, that the vast majority of the movement in the Civil Rights Movement was working class. Most middle class folks in the South were afraid to enter the movement to lose their privilege, the limited privilege that they had. So how does class play into that? And how our class-based movements in America to change America often have been riddled with racism and divided by race over and over again. So it also raises the larger issue of what is the role of nationalism in the 21st century and whose nationalism? And we're talking, of course, African-American nationalism, but beyond that. So we have joined with us here in the studio. Man, we have been dying to get into the studio. He's been on the show numerous times, but by phone. Dr. Jeff Menzies is with us, senior researcher at the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, author of Dumb and Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro. Jeff, good to have you in studio.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here, man.
Dr. Lester Spence is back in the house, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at the Johns Hopkins University. And here with the Center for Emerging Media, he's our scholar in residence, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, which is he's working on a new book right now as well. John Wesley will be here in a minute, got stuck in traffic. He's an author, songwriter, senior fellow in social marketing with the National Center of Health Behavioral Change at Morgan State University, long-term civil rights activist who's working on with us now on a long-term Fannie Lou Hamer documentary project, because he is also the godson of Fannie Lou Hamer. And John Wesley, good to have you with us. Drive safe. Oh, is John, you on the phone? Do we have John potted up? John, you there? Oh, we lost John. Well, see, we can call him back, and maybe he's pulling into the parking lot now. So, gentlemen, good to have you with us.
Thanks, man. Good to be here.
And please join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Let me see what you have to say on our Facebook pages, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner, and we'll see your tweets, and they'll be sent to me, and I will see what you got to say. 410-319-8888. So let's begin with, you know, I think John is back. John, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
All right, man. Good to have you with us. I know you got stuck in traffic, but you'll be here when you get here.
I'm just about there.
All right, good.
Well,
okay. Yeah, so, and also John and I have had many, many long talks about his life in the Civil Rights Movement in the South and the break that happened in the Civil Rights Movement between white and black and John's role in that and what how that affected him. He felt the movement as well. But we'll come to that in a minute. But let's talk about the relevance, Lester Spence. Let me start with you. Mm-hmm. Because you've written and talked a lot about the juncture of nationalism. You identify yourself as a nationalist at times, mm-hmm, on this program, and also the juncture of that and the larger role of kind of radical revolutionary politics. And talk about where you think this, where the relevance of all this is for you in the 21st century.
Well, I think it remains relevant, but I think a bigger question is how can we organize? I think that whatever change we're going to see in America is largely to come from, is likely to come from non-white populations, and given the history of the country, I think it's likely to come from black populations in cities. So I think the big question is what do we have to do to create a movement powerful enough to take hold within those black communities and then extend outward? So the nationalist question is important there. And it becomes particularly important when we're talking about cities like Baltimore that have a majority black population, but black people don't, even though they have a considerable amount of political power, don't seem to have a great deal of economic power and don't seem to have a lot of intellectual power. If you measure intellectual power as, for example, professors at universities outside of Morgan and Coppin, if you measure that as a black presence in the nonprofit sector, we just don't have a great deal of intellectual power, intellectual presence. But with that said, there's a challenge because black nationalism, whenever we talk about black nationalism, what we're talking about is a specific form of nationalism that interrelates with the wider ideology, right? So it's given the dominance of neoliberalism in this particular moment, it's my challenge is that most forms of nationalism that we talk about, that people articulate, are either really black new forms of black capitalism, which don't work for black communities, or they end up hoarding resources within a specific sliver of black people, leaving most black people out, no matter how well-intentioned they are. So that's where the complications are.
And Jeff, your take. Then we're going to kind of delve into it deeply and parse all this stuff out. Jeff Menzies.
Well, as far as the relevancy of black nationalism today, I feel that black nationalism is very relevant. But what I strongly caution us to do is to define clearly what we mean by black nationalism. I mean, there are so many different philosophies and
right.
different types of people that we can couch under the label of being a black nationalist. I mean, I was having a conversation yesterday with Bobby. You know, it's like I would put Dr. Martin Luther King under the umbrella of nationalism just as quickly as I would Malcolm X. And yeah, and that's what I get is I get that look.
But he wouldn't claim that.
It's okay. I mean, because that's what I'm saying. I would package the people. I'm not saying that he himself labeled himself that. Like, mm-hmm. for example, I wouldn't call myself a black nationalist, but people would put me in the category from the outside looking in.
Oh, gotcha. Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying? It's perspective. Mm-hmm. Because what I'm understanding about black nationalism, not only in one instance are people saying we should have our own sovereign nation state, but sometimes people also say we should be self-determining as far as our culture mm-hmm. and our total way of life. And a separate nation state isn't necessary to have that. You see, and so that's why I would say that you can put a whole lot of people in there and it's important for us to define it. So I say that, yes, it's relevant, absolutely relevant, because injustice still exists. And under the heel of injustice tends to still be people of African descent globally. And so we do need this ideology or this sort of mission or this mission driven by justice, the need for justice and reparations for those who are suffering most on the planet. And so absolutely, I say we need black nationalism today, but we should be very careful and very specific and strategic about how we define black nationalism.
And John Wesley.
Yeah, well, Mark, it's kind of ironic that we're talking about black nationalism and we're talking about it during the same week of June that Stokely Carmichael coined the phrase black power.
Indeed.
You know, okay? And one of the things that I remember was a significant breach in the civil rights movement was, in fact, the fact that all of a sudden when black power came in, all of the white people who were down in the civil rights movement were asked to get out of Dodge, you know? I think the other thing to think about, too, is that we have to think about people like Henry Highland Garnett. We have to bring this back into Baltimore, who is really considered one of the fathers of the black nationalism movement. At the same time, if you look at Garvey's movement, and there were about 11 million people that actually got involved, in the movement that Garvey started. However, Garvey always said that he was not trying to in any way promote separation in the races. He was just looking for the possibility that blacks would have a more equal share.
There you go.
So I think it's a good thing to look at, because keep in mind, after all, Stokely Carmichael was forced to leave the movement because a lot of people were not ready for his concepts of black nationalism at the time that he tried to introduce them in the late 60s.
So there's a lot of complexity here with this, and that you all have raised. And let me also say, throw this out. There are two things that strike me. I want to get into in terms of everything you've said, and this is kind of a broad brush at the moment that we're doing here. But part of this was this idea of doing the show is also for Davon Love's project he's doing now at Morgan State University, and he also has this project. He was going to join us, but they couldn't join us today. But we'll get him on as soon as possible to wrestle with this. That had to do with this series of courses he's teaching about for white allies of the black struggle. And then he and I had this dialogue back and forth about that I had problems with that description to start with, as to what we can get into in terms of how that, what the struggle means, and the fact that when you look at where America is and racism, and how racism was really created by the capitalism to justify slavery, that was created by tobacco, cotton, rum, sugar trade, and the enslavement of folks, and creating a kind of a dehumanization of an entire continent worth of people in order to create this system. And so, and you're looking askance at that?
Well, the thing is that, so that naturally leads to the conclusion that if we got rid of capitalism, we wouldn't have racism. And we've got a number of nation states along the ideological spectrum. And whatever nation state you have, you still have black people who are oppressed. When the Soviet Republic, when the Soviet Union existed, they were more liberal, but racism still existed.
Well, what I'm saying is, I think that racism has gotten so embedded in our way of life after 500 years, you can change the nature of the economic system, but then you still have to deal with racism because it's become part of the human structure almost that has to be uprooted out of it.
Now, I'm sure we're all familiar with Dr. Wells' theory of how racism, the origin of racism, how it came about, how it spreads. To recap it quickly, she's a clinical psychiatrist, general practitioner, as well as a child psychiatrist. And she says that the actual origins of racism is the need for white genetic survival. It has nothing to do with economics, saying that economics is actually a spinoff. Based on Neely Fuller Jr., his teaching, he says that it's a spinoff of that need for white genetic survival is a system that includes economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war that all contribute to the continuation of the survival of the white genetic pool. That's what she says the origins of racism is. It has nothing to do with economics
right.
at its core.
And that's a philosophy that I don't adhere to, but that's okay. I think that's
good. I feel you. I feel you. I 100% understand.
But I do understand it.
Yes.
I kind of have a much more social economic base to my theories about where things come from and why they're there.
But most people would, and I say that I've never seen that theory successfully challenged, and I'm not biased either way. I don't have any stakes in it. I respect her greatly. I respect her theory and her work. I've analyzed it. I've seen some of the so-called top scholars try to challenge her, and we can emotionally or for whatever reason challenge it, and that's okay. But when it comes down to it, what's a better explanation?
Well, the reason that's not challengeable is because it's non-falsifiable.
Well, what is? You can't prove that Santa Claus doesn't exist.
You can't? You're asking me to prove a negative?
That's what I'm saying. You said it's not falsifiable.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
A theory should be falsifiable.
I hear you.
If it's not falsifiable, it's something else, right? So to get back to the question, I think that regardless of where it starts, the question is do black people have a right to organize to counter white supremacy? And the answer is they do. They have a right to organize by themselves to counter white supremacy. The question is how do they do that that A, can simultaneously deal with intra-racial politics, right? That doesn't create a dynamic where you have some black people on top and a whole bunch of black people on the bottom, right? And then the broader question is, how do they do that? That creates a more humane organization, a more humane way of organizing society as a whole. That's really the question, right? So, and that's where, again, that's where the challenge is. So, to the extent that a number of organizations in Baltimore have been working with black youth, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Baltimore Algebra Project, Baltimore Urban Debate League, The Intersection, the Inner Harbor Project. The question I have is, the question that Davon and them are trying to ask is like, okay, wow, do black people have a right to organize? And yeah, they do. But the question, then the question becomes, do that mode of organizing they engage in, how does that happen without putting some thin slice on top? And nobody has an answer to that question.
One of the things that I think is important about this is where does the rubber meet the road on this thing? And what I mean in terms of nationalism, you know, when I look at the Jewish culture, and one of the reasons that I know that in the South and probably across the nation that it was very difficult for the notion of black nationalism as we kind of broadly define it to work, was that 70% to 80% of the civil rights movement was funded by the Jewish community and members of the white community. I mean, financially. We knew that if you got in jail, if you need some money, there were some folks that you were calling, you got that money from the Jewish community. Okay, there's no question about that. The other thing, too, I looked at, you know, just last month in May, Billy Saul Estes was buried in Texas. Well, who performed at his funeral? Earl Toon, who wrote Celebration for Cooling the Game. Well, why did he do it? Because Earl Toon was his colleague, and Earl knew about all the money he gave to the civil rights movement. Okay. The question is, when we look at this idea of nationalism, how do we translate a movement for peace, for black empowerment, that the man on the street, the educated guy, the PhD, the, you know, whoever, that everybody can identify with, and that by doing so, they do not isolate themselves from their neighbors next door who may be Jewish, white, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Now, I agree 100% with that notion that we again, redefine it or define it strategically for modern times and what a common agenda and a common good would be. Now, my difficulty with that approach would be that we would end up tiptoeing around certain issues in order to not upset certain populations. And then once again, we may begin to back burner some things that are more pressing and more important for the oppressed populations than they are for the oppressing populations.
Well, I think that we have this situation now. If we look at the LGBT movement and African Americans, I mean, you got a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, I don't have any problem. I got a lot of friends who are gay, okay? But why, I still think that marriage is between a man and a woman, you know? So all of a sudden, I can't talk to my neighbor, you know, or I feel strange talking to my neighbor about this because really, you know, I don't have any problem with, you know, homosexual couples, but at the same time, I don't want to see you kissing my brother in the grocery store.
You can walk in this door. You walked in the door. You can walk in the door. You can't hide the fact that you're black.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Okay, but also there
it's a different issue.
Well, not really, because there are people who wear kufis and there are people who don't.
And sometimes I wear a kufi.
Okay, exactly. I mean, well, listen, you know, hey, James Bevel wore a kufi, you know. I mean,
what does that mean?
So, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, yeah, so what I'm saying is that you can, those are two separate issues. You know, that is not, but see, again, if we don't narrowly define what the agenda is and what the core purpose is, then we can get sidetracked into those types of conversations of, you know, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and tranny community, you know, they also have these issues. And it's like, well, wait a minute, that could be true. But that's not this discussion. And it's not the same as when we're talking about racism. I walk into a Starbucks, I cannot hide the fact that I have African ancestry, you know. You know, in today's melting pot, they may assume some other, you know, bloodlines, you know, because I'm lighter skinned. But, you know, there's still no way I can get away from this. But somebody can walk through the same door and he could be gay. And you can't tell that sometimes by just looking at the person. And so racism is not the same as sexism, is not the same as classism. It's an ism all to itself. You see, and I don't want to. I say if we're
so,
gonna
you
talk
are
about
saying that the issues are not synonymous. LGBT issue and civil rights are not synonymous.
No, I would say this: there may be some points of intersection and some points of overlap, but they are not the same thing.
Okay.
So, what are those places? And I want you to come back in here, Lester. But what are those places, Jeff? You were saying that you have to tippy toe around that would require it being an African American struggle that should not be tippy-toed around. What are you specifically talking about?
Racism.
And what does that mean, though? I know what it means, but I mean, what do you mean in terms of...
Okay, so for example, the theory that I put on the table earlier, Dr. Francis Cress-Wells' theory.
Right.
Now, oftentimes, I've been in many, many discussions where her topic, where her theory may come up, where she herself is presenting, for example, and people will immediately try to shut it down because it creates a general level of discomfort because it takes it away from that quote-unquote, easy to dialogue around economics in class situations. And it brings it to something a little bit more core. And I would like for you to define what not falsifiable means for our listeners, because I think it might have went over some people's head. Just in case.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. I want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about.
No, thank you very much for bringing that up.
But I think that sometimes we are too quick to dismiss things that may make ourselves uncomfortable or make others uncomfortable. Like, for example, Mark, I could have pulled back because I'm sitting next to you right now. But I know better. You know what I mean?
Right.
I know you won't be offended like that. But sometimes we can't have that conversation. And I think that can hinder our progress as far as a move towards justice is concerned.
So real quickly, falsifiability is being able to prove it wrong, right? So if we're talking about science, when people are coming up with the theory of gravity, well, if this thing called gravity exists, we should see that. Then if it doesn't exist, then we don't see that.
So use it in the context of Dr. Wells' theory, though. Why is that unfalsifiable?
Because it's very – there are enough examples of – white. Well, two reasons. One is whiteness is itself a creation, right? So we'd have to articulate where exactly whiteness starts in order for this genetic imperative to see where this genetic imperative is. But the second thing is there are enough examples of either specific white work with African Americans on behalf of for African American individuals or broadly for African American groups, that is hard to actually say where the variance comes from, right? So if you can explain all white behavior by the genetic imperative, so how do you explain whites who don't act this way,
the issue is that it's not all white behavior; it's racist white behavior.
So the other thing I wanted to chime in on was the idea of what exactly it is that black people would want to talk about. And I actually don't think that it's racism. Yeah. I think that black people can talk about racism with whites, but what it is thinking about it materially, right? Is that black people have a power deficit. So in order to, and bringing it home to Baltimore, to neighborhoods in Baltimore, where if black people aren't able to organize by themselves in the neighborhoods where they're dealing with hypersegregation, if other people with more resources and power come in, then what you have is you have an agenda setting program that's going to end up fitting somebody else's agenda more than black people's. Right. More than so Park Heights. Park Heights is the perfect example. They're dealing with all types of stuff. Right. They should be able to organize on their own. Now, they for a number of reasons, they aren't, but they should be able to organize on their own.
Organize what?
Oh, so whatever issue, they're dealing with foreclosures. They're dealing with economic expropriation, unemployment.
We have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back. And let me encourage my listeners. You've heard what's been laid down here. 410-319-8888. Bring your thoughts, theories, ideas to the table. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll be back in just a minute. On our way to break, it's the great John Prime, one of the great voices out of folk music and traditional music in our country, with his great Angel from Montgomery, born on this day in 1946. Happy birthday, John.
Child has grown old. If dreams were lightning and thunder were desire, this old house would have burnt down a long time ago.
gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's War Pigs by Black Sabbath. On this day in 1970, Black Sabbath hit number one with their album Paranoid. Today on the program, we'll bring you some of our favorite segments from the past two decades of the Mark Steiner Show. What you're about to hear is a pre-record, so we can't accept any calls. Please send us any feedback to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. And we are here with Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, and the Center for Emerging Media's Scholar-in-Residence, Dr. Jeff Menzies, who is Senior Researcher at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, author of Dumb and Down, Reflections of the Miseducation of the Negro, John Wesley, author, songwriter, Senior Fellow of Social Marketing, with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change at Morgan State University, and you at 410-319-8888. And Marie, you're on the air. 410-319-8888. Marie, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. In the Sun paper Sunday, this past Sunday, there's an article on the front page stating white deaths outnumber births for the first time, according to the Census Bureau. More white people died in the U.S. last year than were born, a surprising slump coming more than a decade before the census predicts that the ranks of white Americans will drop with every passing year. This will upset some people. No further comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on anybody?
Well, yeah, I mean, as they say, it is what it is. Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. But I do want to come back to something that Dr. Spence mentioned about Park Heights. You know, I find it very interesting when we look at what is going on in Park Heights and we talk about the issues and we're talking about there being a power deficit for African Americans, even though there is a lot of homogeneity, we might say, going on in Park Heights. There's a lot of homogeneity there. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very interesting that the young man who was attacked in Park Heights, the African-American who was attacked by the brothers who happened to be walking through, that with all...
Right,
all the relationships and, you know, the conversation that goes on between the races, that young man was not aware that he was walking through an Eru.
A what?
An Eruv. I give you say
Eruv. Oh, Eruv. Eruv. Okay.
What's
the
Hebrew
term?
Yeah. And okay.
What's that?
Okay. That is a demarcated. Well, Eruv, you explain.
Yeah, but it also
Mark.
Is just baloney. I mean, it's
wait a minute, Mark. Yeah, but let's get you. May it is a demarcated area inside which you are supposed to have a sense of protection. In other words, if you are inside this area, there is always somebody who will hear your cry if you call.
Eruv is a Hebrew term, in Orthodox neighborhoods especially.
But so who was he beat up by? You said brothers. Who?
Oh, he was beat up by some Jewish brothers.
Oh, some white guys.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got to be really clear in this conversation.
Yeah, right.
You
right.
say a black guy beat up by brothers. I'm thinking black on black crime? What are you talking about?
I thought you were aware of the story.
This is what I'm saying, though.
Okay.
But we censor ourselves.
Okay.
Keep going.
But anyway, so the fact that this young man was totally unaware of what he was walking through. Now, Mark say it's a piece of baloney. Yeah, but Mark, if it's baloney, why are there lines on telephone poles and they are maintained by cherry pickers and all of that and spaces made for them by BGE to put their lines up so that their walkie-talkies can communicate with each other? Hmm. Okay. I mean, so when we look at that in terms of now, is that nationalism? Well, in the Jewish community, is it nationalism? I don't know. Maybe so. But I don't have any problem with them doing what is necessary to protect themselves.
Right.
They have a right to do that. My concern is that we should be sharing information as organizations, if it's blacks and Jews or whatever, so that African-American youth who are there, African-Americans in general, know the situation that they're in when they're there.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it's not quite where we are with this discussion right now. But that particular situation, that is an interracial neighborhood of secular Jews, religious Jews, Caribbeans, yeah. African Americans, Latinos, living in a certain area of Park Heights together. And what they did, and what part of that problem is part of the Jewish community, especially in the Orthodox community, mm-hmm. doesn't want to confront their own racism. And the racism that lives inside the Jewish community, in the Orthodox community, does not. They don't want to confront it.
Yeah.
And it has to be confronted, because that's what – there should not be – what this is nationalism. Let's extrapolate this out for a moment. In some ways, this is not – this is Jewish nationalism, that when you have a purely Orthodox Jewish organization patrolling – an interracial neighborhood, mm-hmm. to protect it from what and for whom,
yeah.
is the question.
Yeah.
And so, but and that is where nationalism can sometimes, I don't care whose nationalism it is, mm-hmm. goes awry. I mean, Jewish nationalism, it came out of the oppression in Europe, came out of that it was kind of really exploded onto the scene because of the Holocaust that allowed the State of Israel to be created because there was nowhere else to go for Jews who did not want to go back to Europe, and they wouldn't bring them here and they wouldn't accept them anywhere else. So that nationalism has now become a perverted source of its own liberation. And I would posit, let me just throw this out to y'all. I would posit that nationalism itself eventually perverts itself because of its isolationism, no matter whose nationalism it is.
Yeah, no.
You can say no, but I'm saying yes. Yeah. Tell me why no.
Well, so when you say eventually pervert, it's inside the nature of nationalism
to separate yeah. itself off from anything that's other, that limits the scope of a struggle, and that also can pervert itself into being its own kind of oppressive system.
So is it safe to say that every nation on this planet practices nationalism?
To one extent or another, I think that's true.
Okay, and so, but every nation on this planet does not exude a perverted aspect of nationalism.
It can, though.
It can.
And
definitely,
has,
it definitely can.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
like every individual human being has the potential, you know, to present so-called perverted behaviors. You see, so the potential is always there because we're talking about people systems. We're talking about human interaction. We're talking about the human. My background is in clinical psychology, just to put it in context. We're talking about human behavior as a reflection of their internal thought processes and all the other things that goes on within human beings. And because that is so fragile and so easy to manipulate. I mean, look at any of Watson's work, the behaviorist. It's so easy to manipulate these things. You can create anything that you want as long as it's people involved in that creation. You see what I'm saying? And so with that notion that, yes, nationalism does have the potential to be perverted, quote unquote, perverted into something that is more isolated than inclusive. It can. But nationalism also can help to build more healthy communities because it can instill a certain level of self-pride and self-respect. And typically, self-respecting people are also other-respecting people, meaning they respect others as well. And it tends to be the very insecure person that will demonize or attempt to harm in one way or another another individual. And that insecurity means that there's a lack of self-confidence, a lack of self-love, a self-assurance. And so, again, at that core, absolutely, Mark, it's potential there.
But to follow, and that's an excellent point. Just because it can doesn't mean it always does, right? So there are variants, as John brought up. There's variants in Black nationalism at every point in time, right? There are some forms of Black nationalism that are deeply, deeply, deeply conservative and deeply regressive. Right. And there are other forms of nationalism that actually are not. So one of the tendencies in critiquing Black nationalism is just to argue that it is that it is oppressive, that it is reactionary. And as just Black people doing what other people do. And that goes against its history.
Dick, and if I can add on, speaking to Bobby yesterday about the several instances of Black nationalism throughout the history of the United States, you also find that there was a stereotypical image portrayed of what a Black nationalist was.
Mm-hmm.
And they would take an angry looking Huey P. Newton. You know, they would take an angry looking H. Rap Brown.
Marcus Garvey.
They would take these images, and they were only the angry images, though, not the fact that they were feeding children. You know, they didn't take those. They didn't take the images of educating. They didn't take the images of attempting to thwart drug transactions in the community. They didn't take those. They took the stereotypical angry with an assault rifle on your shoulder. This is black nationalism. It's militancy, and it's a dangerous thing. And that was just a stereotype, because that wasn't and never has been a totality of any nationalistic movement.
You know, and it's interesting. I was looking once again, and I always try to bring this thing, you know, the connection to Baltimore. I was looking at Henry Highland Garnett. He's a guy who was born a slave, you know, and I look at him. And the pictures that we see him, you know, there's a school on Division Street. The school, as a matter of fact, is named for him. Thurgood Marshall went to that school. The fact that when you look at Garnett, you know, there he is in his starch collar, and he has his little goatee, you know, and he's looking all articulate. And some people might say, you know, that he looked white. Hmm. Okay, but on the other
people may look
at that and say that he looked white. Okay, but at the same time, what brought him to that level of acculturation? I say it was a sense of black nationalism,
right?
Mm-hmm. A sense of national pride.
So let me go to the phones here, but I want to see what we think what that means for the struggle in today's world to end racism and supremacy and to transform America. That's what I'm curious. That's what I really want to get to. But we just lost our caller. We'll get somebody to come back. They were there. They're gone. We'll come back. 410-319-8888. What about that? What about the role both of as you're describing it, nationalism in the world today, you know, black nationalism in America today, to end racism and white supremacy, and the larger questions of economic oppression that exists in this country and across the globe that affect more than just African Americans in our society. Course, more deeply, people of color. Lester?
What I've been trying to find while we've been having this discussion is I've been trying to find information about Chokwe Lumumba's program. Chokwe Lumumba
exactly.
Helped found the Republic of New Africa in the 1960s, and he's a lawyer and an activist.
And the new mayor of Jackson,
and the new mayor of
Jackson, Mississippi, my hometown.
Yeah, right. And I'm reading, I'm reading the People's Platform. I'm reading the platform he ran on. It was explicitly a black nationalist program, but every aspect of that program helps everybody in Jackson. Justice. It doesn't just help black people.
And what makes it so important, Lester, is that, listen, I covered the Republic of New Africa trials with Mario Badelli and Wayne James and everybody, you know. And Chokwe was the information minister at the time. Okay, and it is so amazing when I look at what he has done in terms of transforming himself into this person that at one time was raided by the Jackson Police Department as a part of the COINTELPRO program, was one of those people that now he wasn't in the house that night.
Right.
Wayne James and Mario Badelli, were in the house.
Right.
But the fact that now Chokwe is revered and admired by blacks, white people of all races in that city.
We only have like 4 minutes left. How do we interpret that?
If I could jump in, it's the installation again of pride. You know, it's the reparation. It's the repairing of the injury, because what happened is that when Africans were brought here to the United States or to this continent, it was in chains. And their core culture, nature, based on their race and their ancestry, was beat out of them. And that's what the injuries that still exist. And to heal that injury is what's necessary. Black nationalism is what has done so much of that.
Now I'd make a different argument, because I actually don't believe in – I don't believe we've lost our culture.
I don't think we lost our
religion.
It's an injury.
Yeah. I would say that politically he was able to organize people on their culture. Right. And, you know, and our culture is so rich and it works so much. It does so much work for us. It actually makes a lot of sense to actually use it in already segregated communities as an organizing principle.
It's a power.
So real quick, city government. And this is his statement. City government must work to ensure the basic human rights to housing, food, security and health care of the residents of Jackson.
Period.
But that's a black nationalist organizing process.
But it's also a revolutionary platform that goes beyond race.
But who was being disenfranchised when he wrote that?
In Jackson?
Yes.
Primarily black people.
Thank you.
Black
and so he was
primarily.
Saying justice. Oh, yeah. Bring us up.
Yes. If you organize there, it organizes outwards. And that's what I started to show with.
So let's get a quick final thought in here. We have about 3 minutes left in this segment. We're going to come back to this very soon because we're just hitting our stride here.
Yeah, man.
Alan in Baltimore, you're on the air. Quick thought, Alan, please. Alan, you there?
I hope so. Yeah, I'd like to talk about – I'd like to confuse things just a little bit.
And a quick thought, because we won't have much time, so please. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'd like to talk about internationalism, and I think it's important to understand, for example, when the Panthers were organizing against the cultural nationalists, they drew a clear line of demarcation, for example, for people like Ron Karenga. Also, it's important to understand that a lot of the white left tries to sucker bait people into their movement by using phrases like money for jobs, not for war, meaning that American lives, i.e. white lives, are more important than the lives of people around the world. And you can only go so far with nationalism until you realize that this is a common struggle against white racism, against white imperialism.
Okay, Alan, we have to roll here. I'm sorry, but I appreciate the thought. Anyway, I have a 30-second comment to leave us with. 30-second, literally.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, I think in my perspective, it's always been about justice, and it will continue to be about justice.
Yeah,
I want to say it's tantamount to Obama being elected president for Chokwe Lumumba to be the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh no, those are two different things. Lumumba has politics. Lumumba has politics.
John Wesley, Dr. Lester Spence, Dr. Jeff Menzies, thank you all so much.
Hey, appreciate you, Mark.